Okay, it's
Right.
11 a.m. Here in Toronto on the East Coast, and 6 p.m. in Israel, where Dr. Lakshin is. And just by way of introduction, you know, the Zoom classes have for sure been a silver lining in you know, the crazy 15 months that we've had. And you know, Baruch Hashem, we can have all these classes and many people come. And in many ways, I like to feel that we've created a little bit of a community. Here, our Torah in Motion learning community online, and it's a pleasure to see so many people. And you know, many people I've met really only through these classes in the last year and a half. So with that, I just want to pass along some sad news. I'm sure many of you know, if you've been coming on class the last number of weeks. So Dr. Lakshin is often talking to Pearly Hermant. She's, you know, been coming to all our classes and very lively and knowledgeable. And unfortunately, all of a sudden, she passed away this past week. We were talking to her last week, last Wednesday at the class.
Yeah.
So I just want to express our condolences sort of as a community to the family. I did not really know her, even though she grew up, she's in Toronto. She's a Torontonian, but I've really only met her through the classes here on Zoom. So I just want to pass along the sad news. And Dr. Lakshin, I think, who knew her much, much better than I did, can add.
She knew your father's family. She knew your father. I'm her niece. She knew your father's family very well.
I know, correct. I know. Yeah, when I found out that her siblings, I know the siblings. And I was right. She's a Friedberg. I know that. Yes, yes.
Yes.
Her brother, yes. And I guess I went to school with, you know, Esther, with her niece, and correct. I know the family, and I just, you know, I don't know everybody in Toronto. What can I say? But we should hear good news. Okay. Yes.
Yes. As Rabbi Keltman said, it was a shocking loss. Pearly was here in the class last week, vibrant, alive, participating, discussing, and she also has been attending another class that I've been teaching, and she was a very, very impressive woman. It wasn't all that easy for a woman of her age, she's a number of years older than me, to get the excellent education in Hebrew and Tanakh that she had, and she had just amazing knowledge of the Hebrew language and care about the care about Hebrew grammar and excellent knowledge of Tanakh. And she was almost blind for the last few years, and like she couldn't, she made it clear to me she couldn't follow any of these slides on the screen, but she had this thirst for knowledge, and she participated in Torah Shebaal Peh, in the oral Torah of these classes. And she was a person of great a great sense of humor, and really nice human being, aside from being very intelligent and very committed to Jewish texts and Jewish studies. And she will be missed, and I want to dedicate today's class. I prepared today's class before she died, so it isn't that the topic for today is dedicated to her, but we're studying Torah and dedicating our study in memory. Le'ilui nishmat Penina bat Chaim Halevi v'Rachel, Pearly Hermit. Okay, last week we studied about allegory and halakha, and we saw various texts in which people expressed, particularly Abraham Ibn Ezra, expressed his dismay at the idea of people offering allegorical interpretations of legal texts in the Bible. So in today's session, we will be concentrating on three texts, if we manage to get to all three of them, but we're starting with this saying that goes back to the Mechilta, the Midrash that was written in the days of the Tanaim, quoting Rabbi Yishmael, Rabbi Yishmael, who lived in the second century, is seen traditionally as being the author or the editor of the Mechilta. And in this text, Rabbi Yishmael suggests that there are actually three texts that ought to be, three legal texts in the Bible that ought to be read as a mashal, as a metaphor, as an allegory, and it should not be read literally. And what are those three texts? Okay, we'll see his statement here about the three texts. And then we'll go through each one of them. If he rises again and walks on his mishenet, we'll see it in the context in a minute. A mishenet, the simplest understanding of the word mishenet, is a walking stick, a cane. And Rabbi Yishmael says, no, this shouldn't be understood as meaning a walking stick or a cane. It should be understood as meaning that he walked on his own strength. And the Mechilta says, and this is one of three expressions in the Torah that Rabbi Yishmael used to interpret as a mashal. Some of you might know that it was actually the great rabbi, professor Abraham Joshua Heschel, who was the first one who came up with the theory that the big difference between Rabbi Yishmael and Rabbi Akiva, maybe the two leading scholars in the first half of the second century in the land of Israel, is that Rabbi Yishmael was more interested in the pshat and the plain meaning of the text and stayed close to the plain meaning of the text. And Rabbi Akiva was willing to offer interpretations that had very little to do with the pshat. But here we have a statement that is actually Rabbi Yishmael saying, these three texts, don't take them literally. When it says mishenet, it doesn't mean mishenet. It means that he's walking around on his own strength. We'll see the context in a minute. And the second text is kayotzebo im zarcha hashemesh alav. The text that says, if the sun shines on him, to which Rabbi Yishmael says, if the sun shine only on him? What does it mean, the sun shines on him, on an individual? The sun shines on the entire world? Doesn't it shine on the entire world? Rather, interpret the verse to say, if just like the sun is the sign of peace in the world, so also if you know about the thief that he feels peace towards you and you still kill him, you are guilty. So the sun shining here should be understood metaphorically, allegorically here as a statement about, you know that the person is not your enemy. We'll see the context. And then the last one, similarly, it says in the case of the man who is claiming that the woman that he married was not a virgin, it says, ufarsu hasimla, they shall spread out the sheet. And that means that, according to Rabbi Yishmael, there's no sheet here that's being talked about. But it means that they should investigate completely and make the matter as clean as a white sheet. Okay, so here are his three examples where the Torah says something that sounds like it's describing something concrete, a walking stick, the sun shining, or a sheet. And for all three of these texts, Rabbi Yishmael says, don't read this text literally. Okay, let's go through them one at a time and see what Rabbi Yishmael is actually suggesting. The first text, when men quarrel and one of them strikes the other one with a stone or with a fist, and he does not die, but has to take to his bed. So the second verse reads, in yakum vehitalech bachutz al nishanto v'nika hamakeh rak shivto yitain. If the person who was hit gets up and walks outdoors on his mishenet, and the JPS reasonably enough translates the words mishenet as meaning his staff, his walking stick, the assailant shall go unpunished, except that he must pay for his idleness and for his cure. What is the legal issue here? The legal issue here is we have a case of assault, and the person who was assaulted is sick and in bed. And then the question is whether the assault, if this person later dies, can the assault be seen as the cause of the death? And so I guess that today, this legal issue could still occur today, that there is a case of assault and somebody's in bed, in hospital, or at home, and then dies 3 days later, 3 weeks later, 3 months later, 3 years later, and you're trying to decide, did the person die because of the assault that took place beforehand? So I'm guessing that possibly, if we were to have a legal case about something like this today, that the it might be dependent on an autopsy, on a postmortem, on an examination, that if the state, if the province wanted to prefer charges against this person for murder, then they might do an autopsy on the deceased in order to decide whether, some of you who know medical things better than I do might know better than I, but that would be my guess about what we would do today, that the state would bring this evidence to court that would show that the assault was directly the cause of the death, even if a number of hours, days, months, or possibly even years went by between the time of the assault and the time that the person died. And the standard halachic understanding here is that while the person who was assaulted is sitting there in this kind of state of limbo, and we're not sure whether he or she is going to live, that the person who committed the assault is put into custody until it's determined whether the person is going to live or not. And then it says that the person is released. The assailant shall go unpunished. V'nika hamakeh will say, okay, obviously you are not guilty of murder. All you are guilty here of is assault. And of course you have to pay the bills for the for healing. You have to pay the hospital bills. You also have to pay like the unemployment insurance, the work that this person was unable to do. So the assailant still has financial responsibilities because of this, but the assailant will not be considered a murderer. And what is the cutoff point? How do we know, according to the Torah, according to the Pshat understanding of the Torah, criterion is that if the person who was assaulted stayed in bed, was never able to get out of bed and walk around, then we assume that the assault was what caused the person's death. However, if the person got out of bed and was able to walk around, even if he had to use a mishenet for walking around, even if he was walking around using a using his staff, using his walking stick, then we would say, okay, we now think that his death is not directly attributable to the assault, and the assailant will only be responsible for these financial penalties, and the assailant will not be responsible for the murder. We won't say that there was a murder here, even if he died after walking around outside. So it's interesting that Rabbi Ishmael's reading of the text makes this stricter, because Rabbi Ishmael's reading, which is adopted here by Rashi, Rashi says, al mishanto, al buryo v'kocho. Al mishanto means that he walked around on his own steam and his own strength, which seems to imply that he was walking around without a walking stick, that it's a different level of activity, a higher level of activity that was required in order to prove that that the assault was not the direct cause of the death of the person, the death of the victim. So that's what Rabbi Ishmael said back in the previous text, al Borio, on his own strength. And Rashi says the same thing, following this approach. Last week, we saw that Abraham, even Ezra, had this kind of ambivalent attitude towards towards allegorical interpretations of biblical texts. In his earlier works, he wrote, you know, there are two possibilities for understanding this text that could be understood allegorically, or it could be understood according to the interpretation given by the classical rabbis. And then later on, in his later years, after he'd moved to northern France, and possibly after he had come in contact with pshat commentators of the Bible who were even more radical than he in the in their dedication to pshat, then he started towing the line more and accepting the rabbinical interpretation, the traditional rabbinical interpretation. The same thing happens here. Again, we have the benefit. We see the early commentary that Ibn Ezra wrote on the book of Exodus and the later commentary that he wrote on the book of Exodus. So in the earlier commentary, his shorter commentary on the book of Exodus that you will not find in the traditional Mikraot Gedolot collections, compendia, you will find it in the Torah Chaim, Mikraot Gedolot, and in some other good editions. You can find this his earlier commentary on Exodus. He begins by saying, Al Mishanto, Kamo, Ve'ish Mishanto, Biyado, Merov Yamim. Walking on a Mishenet should be understood like the verse, old men and old women will be sitting in the streets of Jerusalem, each one of them holding on to a Mishenet, Merov Yamim, because they're so old, the people here in Jerusalem, living such long lives, that the city will be filled with old men and old women all using walking sticks. And I said, but that obviously what Mishenet means in the book of Zechariah, and so presumably that's what it means also here in Exodus. But, says Ibn Ezra, the rabbi said that on his Mishenet means walking unaided, meaning that he needs to lean on no one. Shelo yisha'ein al acher, that he's nishan, he's leaning on himself, he's balancing himself on his own feet, without getting any help in the balancing. And then, even as Ezra finishes, as we saw him finishing last week when he dealt with texts of this nature, the first explanation is then canceled, since the second one has such trustworthy witnesses to its truth. The rabbis, the ancient rabbis, Rabbi Yishmael, back there in the second century, he said that that's what the text means. And so that's what the text means. And so, you know, I'm telling you that on the shot level, it actually looks like it means walking stick, but that's not what it means. It really means walking around unaided. But that's what he said in his earlier commentary on Shmot. Then in his later commentary on Shmot, after he moved to northern France, he says, this is called the longer commentary, but here it's shorter because he only gives you the one interpretation. He says, Im yakum al kadmoneinu nismoch sheperushu ki al mishanto shelo yishain al acher kemishpat acholim rak al atzmo. We will rely on our ancestors. It's possible that there's a little play on words here. It's a question of what this person is leaning on, what he's relying on. He's saying, we will rely on our ancestors. We will rely on Rabbi Yishmael from back in the second century, who said that Mishanto actually means that he's not leaning on anybody or anything else, as ill people generally do. But in order to prove that this person has recovered from the assault that he or she received, we need for him or her to be walking around unaided. And so we see Ibn Ezra toying here in his earlier commentary with, there's the pshat understanding and there's the allegorical understanding being promoted by Rabbi Yishmael. And later on, Ibn Ezra says, just plain and simple, we're going to interpret this verse the way the traditional rabbis interpreted this verse. What we are going to see today, the surprise that we're going to see today, is that even in the all of these texts where Rabbi Ishmael says, please interpret this concrete image here in this text, please interpret it in a non-concrete way, please interpret it in a metaphorical kind of way, still in each of these texts, we will find one of the great Torah commentators from medieval times who just doesn't like the idea of doing it. And despite the fact that Rabbi Ishmael, this great authority for the second century, said to offer a metaphorical to accept the metaphorical understanding of the text, we will find proponents of the literal understanding. And here, Ramban, the great Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman, lived at the end of the 12th and the beginning of the 13th century, and moved from Spain here to Jerusalem late in life. He here is the defender of the literal understanding of the text. He writes on his Mishenet, in other words, on his own steam and his own strength, that's what Rashi says. And Ibn Ezra says that it means that he should no longer be leaning on other people as sick people often are, but he should be walking on his own. And then the assailant will be considered not guilty of murder, and he will be released from custody, that we put the person in custody until we found out whether the person who he assaulted is going to succeed in getting out of bed. And then he writes, Ulafita ati ki mishanto ki pshuto kamo the ish mishanto biato meirov yamim. Ramban, the great halachist, the great defender of the Talmudic understanding of the text, he's committed to the literal, concrete understanding of the text, and he says, you know, I think that we have to interpret the word mishenet here just the way we interpreted it in Zechariah, where it's talking about the old people sitting around in the streets of Jerusalem, holding on to their walking sticks in order to get around. And then he explains, so what does it mean? The verse then says that the assailant will be freed once the victim becomes sufficiently strong to walk outside in the streets and the marketplaces with a walking stick, the way that a weak person who has just recovered from illness would. And so he says that once we have the person wobbling around outside of his or her home with a walking stick, yeah, then we can say that when the person later dies, it wasn't a result of the assault that took place, because we see that the person did recover from the assault. In other words, this is a more lenient position about the person who committed the assault. We need a higher level of proof in order to be able to attribute the death of the victim to the assault. It's amazing that Ramban feels that he can defend the concrete, literal understanding of the text, although there's this tradition of interpretation beforehand that offered the allegorical understanding. Perhaps, I'm just throwing out this idea, perhaps this is all connected to what I saw, to what we saw last week when we looked through a number of texts where rabbis spoke out extremely strongly against offering non-concrete understanding of concrete terms in legal texts. And we suggested last week that it could be a result of a polemic against Christian understandings of texts. That's example number one. We'll go on to example number two. Example number two is an interesting text in the translation of the JPS. Exodus 22, if the thief is seized while tunneling, in other words, trying to break into my home at night, is the standard understanding. He's digging underneath the home in order to come into the home. Unfortunately, tunneling has become something that it gets talked about quite a bit here in Israel with tunnels to try to be able to attack the state of Israel coming from Gaza. The thief is seized while tunneling and he is beaten to death. That's the JPS translation, v'hukah v'met. I don't know if I translate v'hukah as beaten to death. They strike him and they kill him. There is no blood guilt in his case. Ein lo damim. Again, that's the JPS translation. There is no blood guilt in his case. And then the next verse says, if the sun has risen on him, there is blood guilt in that case. Im zarcha hashemesh alav, damim lo. He must make restitution, and if he lacks the means, then he shall be sold for his theft. So the question is, are we dealing, what is our attitude to the person who is breaking into our home? The person who is breaking into our home, if the thief is killed while breaking into the home, ein lo damim, but if the sun shines on him, there is damim. I will get to the question of the sunshine, and that is actually what Rabbi Yishmael was talking about. So what does it mean to say that there's a difference between tunneling and the first clause, and the second clause talks about the sun shining? But there's also another interesting interpretive issue in understanding this verse, which also has to do with metaphorical and literal understanding of the text. That phrase, ein lo damim, which JPS translated as, there is no blood guilt in his case, that's not how Rashi understood the text. Ein lo damim, Rashi writes, ein zo ritzicha, this is not murder, why not? Hare hu kemit meikaro, because it is as if he, the person who got killed, was already dead in the first place. So in other words, Rashi looked at this verse. If the thief is breaking into your house and he is hit and he dies, he does not have any blood. So Rashi is suggesting this means it's as if that thief who was breaking into your house didn't have any blood in his veins. And why didn't he have any blood in his veins? Because he was dead already. So there was a dead person breaking into your house. That's what ein lo damim means. It means the thief, it's as if the thief does not have blood in him. So that's how Rashi understands this phrase here. Ibn Ezra says, uperush ein lo damim ein al horgo shvichut damim. The meaning of he has no blood is that there is no blood guilt on the person who kills that thief. So, you know, looking back at the verse again, ein lo damim, he has no damim. So who's the he that's being referred to? Ein lo damim. In the English, there's no he at all, but in the Hebrew, there's ein lo damim. He does not have any damim. So according to Rashi, it means he, the thief who was killed, it's as if the thief who was killed does not have any blood in his veins. And so a murder could not take place because he's dead already. And according to Ibn Ezra's understanding, it means the person who killed the thief who was breaking in does not have any blood guilt, that there's no guilt on him. He has no blood, is that there is no blood guilt on the person who kills that thief. And then Ibn Ezra says, it is baffling that some interpret damim here as meaning life. How would they then explain such phrases as a man of damim, that means a murderous person, or his blood is upon him, meaning that he has blood guilt? So we see, according to Ibn Ezra, that the plural of the word dam means blood guilt, And it is generally assigned, this word is assigned to the guilty person and not to the victim, to the person who has perpetrated this act of homicide, and not to the person who is the victim of the act of homicide. So where in the world did Rashi get off on suggesting that ein lo damim means that the person who was breaking in was considered to already be dead as he was breaking in. I always used to like teaching this text when I taught Exodus back at York University, because I think that it's a really interesting problem here. There's a problem between like the dictionary definition of that word damim, which actually Ibn Ezra is very, very right that other uses of the plural of dam seem to be referring to the responsibility on the person who is, so the dictionary definition is right. But Rashi has a very strong argument in favor of his interpretation, as we shall see right now. Shatal, Samuel David Luzzatto in the 19th century, one of my favorite commentators, as many of you know, probably my favorite commentator on the among the modern commentators. And one of the things I've always liked about Shatal is his honesty and how often he changes his mind, which I think that anybody who interprets biblical verses has to be willing to change their mind often, because you learn more and you get a bit more understanding of text. Rashbam was the one who came up with the phrase "Hapshatot amitchadshim b'chol yom," that every day there are newly understood pshat understandings of the text. So Shatal begins his commentary. He says here, Shatal actually never wrote a commentary, never published a full commentary on the Torah in his life. He left behind notes that were published after he was a Bible teacher in the Collegio Rabbinico in the modern Orthodox rabbinical seminary in Padua for almost his entire life. And he left behind his notes for his classes that go through the entire Torah and various other books of the Tanakh. And a few years after he died, his Torah commentary was published from his notes by his students. And here's what it said in his notes. He said, "For many years, I interpreted this passage following Ibn Ezra. And I used that interpretation in my commentary published in 1851. In 1851, he published a commentary just on Parshat Mishpatim, just on Exodus chapter 21, 22, 23, and maybe 24. And he says, "But now, Erev Shavuot, 1859, I've changed my mind. And I see that the subject of the verse and the next verse is the thief, not the homeowner." That's the very strong argument that Rashi has for his interpretation, that the homeowner is never mentioned here. It's all passive. The hukah bamit. He was hit, and it doesn't mention who hit him, and he dies. The only person who is mentioned in verse in these two verses here is the thief. And so to say that the verb lo, he has no damim, applies to the person who hit him, is a very clumsy argument from the syntax point of view, Shatal realizes. And that's the strength of Rashi's interpretation that he figured out on Erev Shavuot in 1859. "I see that the subject of the verse and the next verse is the thief, not the homeowner. The meaning of he has no damim is that he, the thief, is not considered a living person with blood flowing through him." It's as that's how I interpreted Rashi, because I read Shadal's understanding of Rashi, that it means there is no blood running through his veins. He is considered dead. U'nechshav kamit. So the person who killed him killed someone who was legally dead already. For those of you with some Aramaic, you can see it on the left-hand side there. Gavra k'tila k'tal, a Talmudic phrase that is used about the question of what happens if somebody kills a person who is defined halachically as being a treifa, someone who is about to die. The doctors say this person is going to die in the next hour, in the next day, whatever, and somebody comes in and kills that person. Of course, that's not a permissible act according to halacha, but is it murder according to halacha? It's not murder according to halacha because the Gemara says, Gavra k'tila k'tal. He killed somebody who's already dying, and so that's not the same as killing somebody who is not not about to die. The whole question of both of these texts that we have seen so far is the question of what does it mean to be alive, and what does it mean to be dead, and what does it mean to go from being alive to being dead? Yesterday at Pearlie Herman's funeral, which I was able to attend, and I assume that some other people here were also able to attend because of the good services of Benjamin's, that are providing a nice kind of television broadcast of the funeral. Her older brother, Rabbi Ben Friedberg, began by saying, you know, we all remember that we're all going to die. And but the question is, when is it going to take place? And the shock of when it takes place, even though we all realize that we are going to die. But so all of us, each of us is, of course, immortal. And in a certain sense, each one of us is a gavra k'tila, is somebody who is going to die. But there is a difference between somebody who's going to die right now because of the situation that he or she is in, and somebody who is just going to die at some further time in the future. Shadal continues, both Ibn Ezra and Mendelssohn found this metaphorical, poetic language difficult. What Rashi said, hayakashelahim halashon hazeh hamushal v'hashiri. That's what Rashi was actually doing. He was looking at that phrase, ein lo damim. Now, obviously, if you say that damim actually means blood, then it's not literal, because you can't say there was no blood in the veins of the person who was killed. Of course there was blood in the veins of the person who was killed, but it's metaphorical, lyrical, poetic language. But Shadal, who was a poet himself, said that Ibn Ezra and Mendelssohn didn't, Ibn Ezra was also a poet. It's a shocking aspect of Ibn Ezra's commentary on the Torah is that while Ibn Ezra himself was a poet, he didn't like relating to passages in the Torah as being poetic. But Shadal says, you know, this is obviously poetic language, saying he does not have any blood. It's not saying that he doesn't have any blood in the veins. It's just saying he doesn't. It's as if he isn't still alive. That a person who was alive would be considered dead as if he had no blood. And they offered unlikely explanations, so they twisted the syntax to get ein lo damim to refer to the person who did the killing instead of the person who got killed. And then Shadal finishes off. But Rashi had a palate that could accurately taste Hebrew idioms. I like that phrase. And of course, that is also lyrical, metaphorical, poetic language. It isn't that Rashi's palate actually tasted the words, but when Rashi saw a Hebrew phrase, it resonated with him in the right way. And he could recognize poetry as poetry, and he could recognize metaphor as metaphor. Behevin ha-davar al-burio, and he understood the matter correctly. So that's the first issue of metaphorical or lyrical or poetic understanding of this text. But the other issue is the question, just going back and reminding ourselves what it says in the text, there's a difference whether the thief is tunneling in there or if the sun has risen on him. So the Talmud offers two interpretations of what it means for the sun to rise on the person who is breaking into the house. The first explanation, the rabbis taught, there is no blood if the sun shines on him. Does the sun shine only on that thief? Rather, the verse means, if the matter is clear to you as sunshine, that he is approaching you in a manner that is not peaceful, then kill him. Otherwise, do not kill him. So I'm at home and I find somebody breaking into my home here. The principle here, the legal principle that became a principle in the Western world, the principle of Hava lehorgecha hashkem lehorgo, that if somebody is coming to kill you, you have the right to kill them before they kill you. And it can be assumed that if somebody is breaking into your house, that they are willing to kill you. That's the underlying assumption here. So the first interpretation suggests, if it's clear to you that he really wants to kill you, then you can kill him. But otherwise, you're not allowed to kill him, meaning if you don't know for sure, you don't recognize the person coming in, so you have no idea whether that person would be willing to kill you or not. So according to this first understanding, if it's clear to you that he is approaching you in a belligerent manner, then you can kill him. Otherwise, do not kill him. And then the other metaphorical reading makes the opposite kind of conclusion. A different braita reads, if the sun shines on him, does the sun shine only on that thief? Rather, the verse means, if it is clear to you as sunshine that he is approaching you in a peaceful manner, then don't kill him. If you see somebody breaking into your house and he's your best friend, and you're thinking to yourself, would that person actually be willing to kill me? So if it's your best friend, then don't kill them. But otherwise, if you don't know whether this person is coming to kill you or not, you're allowed to assume that that person is coming there to kill you. In an amazing expansion of this text there in the Talmud that I didn't give you here, but I'm sure some of you who have read this chapter of Sanhedrin know the rather shocking and disturbing Freudian kind of analysis that is offered there in the Talmud, where they say that if you're at home alone and you see your father breaking into your home, then you can assume that your father is not coming to kill you. But if you are at home alone and you see your son breaking into your home, then it's possible that your son is coming to kill you. So whatever you say about that, the text is making a distinction between, so what's the sunshine? It has nothing to do with sun. It only has to do with the question of what is the level of the certainty of your knowledge about the situation. And it could work, according to the Gemara, there are two different directions that it could work. And so here we see Rambam, Maimonides, and the Mishneh Torah, writing in the laws of theft, writing, Ababa machteret bein bayom bein balayla ein lo damim. So Rambam, knowing what it says, that there's a distinction between whether the sun is shining or the sun is not shining, he said, this law is the law, whether it is during the day or at night. In other words, do not interpret the phrase there, if the sun shines, as being literal. It's a metaphorical statement here about the level of knowledge that you have about the situation. In other words, if the homeowner or another person kills the thief, the murderer is exempt from punishment. So if somebody is coming on the principle of Hava lehorgecha hashkem lehorgo, that if somebody's coming to kill you, you're allowed to kill them. And the amazing halachic expansion of this is also that if you see X trying to kill Y, you, the bystander, are allowed to kill X. This principle is not just a principle in halakha, it's a principle in all Western legal systems that I know of, and a highly respected professor of law at Yale named Robert Cover, Zichrono Libracha. He was an observant Jew, was a brilliant professor of law who sadly died in his 40s. He wrote about this issue and, you know, what kind of rationales are offered in different legal systems to explain why it is that a bystander is allowed to actually, in a certain sense, serve as judge and jury, watching this attempted murder take place. We all know that sometimes it's not easy to know who the victim is and who the assailant is, but there is this legal principle that allows the bystander to get involved, and that's what Rambam says here: Im harago bal habayit o she'ar ha'adam piturim. The murderer is exempt, whether the murderer is the homeowner whose life itself is in danger, or somebody else who just is watching this unfold. Any person is allowed to kill that tunneling chief. He makes that tunneling thief, sorry, in any manner of killing. And if the homeowner knew with certainty that the thief was not willing to kill, only to steal, it is forbidden to kill the thief. But if you know, you're looking at this thief breaking into your house and you said, this person would not be willing to kill me. The only reason that you are allowed to kill the thief who is breaking into your home is because you think that there's the possibility that the thief might be willing to kill you. But if you know that that is not the case, so Rambam essentially follows the second opinion, the second brayta here. If you know for sure that the person is not there to kill you, it is forbidden to kill the thief. But he begins here with the statement, it doesn't matter whether the thief is coming during the day or at night, despite what the text talks about the sun shining. As many or most of you know, Rabbi Avraham ben David, the Rabbad or Ravid, as he's referred to in the Yeshivot, who was an older scholar than Rambam, lived in Provence in the south of France, wrote little glosses on Rambam's work of Jewish law, and generally disagreeing with Rambam. Sometimes disagreeing with Rambam in very strong language, and sometimes just making a comment on it. As I said, Rabad was older than Rambam, 28 years older than Rambam, and it's possible that he felt from his works, it seems that he might have felt that Rambam was this young whippersnapper who was writing a work in Jewish law, and that actually he shouldn't have been seen as this great authority. Rabad begins here in this rhetorical flourish. I'm not going to refrain from writing my own opinion. Okay, I know what everybody said. I read the Talmud. I read Rambam. I read all of these things. But, you know, I'm going to tell you what I think anyways. Shenirali. אפעל פי שדרשו חכמים עם זרחה השמש עליו דרך משל, אם ברור לך הדבר כשמש שלא בא לסכן נפשות, אפעל פי כן אין מקרא יוצא מדי פשוטו. You know, the rabbis offered their midrashic explanation of the sun shines on him as a mashal, as a metaphor. If it is clear to you that he's not coming to kill you, still the verse should not depart from its pshat, meaning that there's a difference whether it's taking place at night or during the day. And Rabad is going to explain that on the next slide. A thief who comes during the day may not be killed. If you see a thief breaking into your house during the day, you're not allowed to kill him. Why? Because the thief has come just to grab possessions quickly and then run away. Thieves have no intention of taking large amounts nor of killing the homeowners unless they come at night. That thief knows, the thief who comes at night knows that the homeowner is at home. That thief, again, the thief who comes at night, knows that he either will kill or be killed. Somebody who breaks into a house, when he knows that the inhabitants of the house are home, that means at night, when he knows that they are home, that person is coming willing to kill you, and that's why you are allowed to defend yourself. The thief who comes during the day does so because he assumes that the homeowner is away from the house. A lot of our homes are empty during the day, at least not during when it isn't Corona time, when you are actually allowed to leave your house and to go somewhere that's, it could be assumed that during the day, the house is sitting there empty. He just wants to grab something quickly. Nice Aramaic there. Shmuta ba'almahu. He's just, he wants to chop. He wants to grab. He just, you know, he's coming quickly to grab something here. And then he finishes off and says, v'chayei roshi kol mevin dai lo baseh. And by my life, this exclamation ought to suffice for any person of understanding. It's an interesting interpretation. And, it leads. So first of all, here's another example of, despite the fact that traditional literature, including the Talmud, including the Midrashei Halakha, are all suggesting that something should be interpreted metaphorically, along comes Rabad, this great halachist, who's obviously no critic of Halakha, but he's just saying, you know, we can't ignore the plain meaning of the text, and this explanation ought to suffice for any person of understanding. You don't need anything more than this explanation. So that there's the attraction of the people from the tradition to the plain meaning of the text. This isn't a case that would come up very often in halachic courts, in a beit din, to deal with a situation like this. But there's a big difference between what Rambam writes here, that it doesn't matter whether it was during the day or at night, and what Rabad says here, that you're allowed to kill the thief who's breaking into your house only during the day. I'll just finish off by pointing out, some of you might know that in the law code of Eshnunna, a law code that's almost 4,000 years old from Mesopotamia, people like to point out the similarities between the law code of Eshnunna and also the law code of Hammurabi and the laws that appear in the Bible, particularly in Parshat Mishpatim, particularly in what we call the covenant code in Exodus 21, 22, 23. So what does it say in the law code of Eshnunna? A man who was caught in the field of a merchant, nobody is quite sure how to translate the word there that's translated here as merchant, in the crop during daytime shall pay 10 shekels of silver, but if he's caught there in the crop at night, he shall die. A man who was caught in the house of a merchant in the house during daytime shall pay 10 shekels of silver. He was caught in the house at night shall die. And when the law code of Eshnunna was discovered, people said, oh, right away you see that the Torah has basically just taken the law from Eshnunna, but it is definitely not the case, because in Eshnunna it says that this law applies whether it is in the field or in the house. And in the field, there's no danger to human life if the thief is breaking into your field at night. There's not the whole principle in the Torah is the rule of Aba lohorgecha hashkem lehorgo. But in Eshnunna, the principle is, I'm not sure what the principle is in Eshnunna, but it appears that the principle is that somebody who does something like this at night is, that's dastardly and nefarious to do something like this at night, and a person like this deserves to die. And it's not out of protection, but just somebody who is a great danger to society if he's willing to go around into people's fields at night, stealing from the field at night. So you can kill a thief like this, because in Eshnunna and Hammurabi, very often thieves get the death penalty. And the Torah gets rid of this, and so the same model is here. Is it possible that the attraction originally of the metaphorical understanding of this text was because of wanting to get away from this this kind of technical model, that the only difference is whether it was during the day or at night? I don't know. I'm just throwing that out as a possibility. And I will not get to the third example today, nor will I get to it next time. We'll come to a we'll deal with a different text next week, and let's take a look at the chat and see what we have there. Okay, go back to earlier chats. Somebody asked what my other class is. Drop me an email, launchen@yorku.ca. I'll answer the question. Ilana said, Pearlie brought such a lively spirit to the classes. That is very true. Okay. Catherine says, Exodus 21 sounds like a workers' compensation investigation where the insurance company sends someone to spy on the injured person's activity to see if they have exaggerated the injury. Catherine, I'm with you 100%. That is what it sounds like. Just, you know, you go to check out to see did the person, they're claiming that they die, have they been walking around with or without a walking stick? Maybe Mishena means a Philippine caregiver. Okay, I mean, it could be. I guess that's the, I'm sure that many of you know that here in the in Israel, the word Filipinit means caregiver. It doesn't matter what nationality the caregiver is, but the word Filipinit just means caregiver in this country. I don't know if we should be proud of that, but that is the usage in modern Israeli Hebrew. Are these, iPad asks, are these different interpretations in agreement with the science medical knowledge of the day? I assume that that is the case. Or the other possibility is that there wasn't clear scientific medical knowledge of the, that there wasn't any simple formula for figuring out whether the person died because of the assault. And so, Exodus 22, what is the antecedent of the he and his? Miriam asked that at 6:27 before I raised that question. Miriam, you're absolutely right. As we pointed out in the continuation, that is the basis for Rashi's interpretation, that the he and the his has to be the thief, because that's the only noun that is there. Hats off to you, Miriam, for realizing that ahead of time. Zev writes, who is sold for what theft in the biblical world? If you steal and you cannot repay it, the rule is v'nimkar b'gnevato. It becomes an eved ivri, becomes a Jewish servant. There's a limited number. No matter how big the theft is, you can't be in this position for more than 6 years. And this was actually that. To us, this does not sound very progressive, but this was actually pretty progressive for the ancient world, because in the ancient world, if you stole and you couldn't repay what you stole, then you were killed. And the Torah came along and said, no, you never kill a thief. But you, if he can't repay it, then he goes to work off his debt, and he can only work it off for a certain number of years. And if he didn't work it off at that point, he goes free anyways, even though he hasn't
worked. What was stolen here?
So, it doesn't say what was stolen, but he is referred to as Haganav. So,
the second half of the pasuk is very
important. Im sarcha shalav damim lo, meaning you can't kill him. Shalem yishalem. So it says that he has to pay, and the assumption has to be that he pays for what he stole. He has to make, you're right, Seb, it doesn't say that directly, but you have to assume that is to be understood from the text.
But I thought he was dead.
No, in the first part it says, the first verse it says, if you kill him, elo damim, that's fine. But in the second half, particularly if we take Rashi's understanding, he's still alive. And since he's still alive, you're not allowed to kill him. So what's the penalty that he's going to have? He's going to have to repay what he stole. Ein lo, yesh, damin lo. This is a living person. You're not allowed to kill that person for breaking into your house. And what claim do you have against him? You have the financial claim. If he steals something from your home, he will repay it. And if he can't repay it, then he will become your slave for a short period of time in order to work off the debt. You're right, Zev, you have to add things to the verse to say that, but I think that's how you have to understand it. Gershon says, dead man walking. Yes, that's a good translation of Gavra Katila Katal. Yes, Susanna says, seems very odd to say that he's dead already, but Shadal thinks that that's the lyrical, poetic way that the Torah said it. Batya says, so if we're attacked and we fight back, we're not guilty if the attacker did. That's the whole principle of Abba Lehorgecha Hashkem Lehorgo. Yes, Batya, certainly the case. What about Demei Achicha Tzoakim? Ah, yes. You're right, Epi. I said that Ibn Ezra cited these various plural uses of damim and said that the plural uses of damim seem to have something to do with blood guilt. But Epi is right in the phrase, in the murder of Abel by Cain, it says, Demei Achicha Tzoakim. There are all sorts of midrashim on why the plural is used there. And so we do see that the plural of dam is sometimes used when it's referring to blood, to human blood. Here it's not live human blood. It's not quite the same as what Rashi understood. Damim lo, ein lo damim. This is the blood of a dead person is being referred to with the plural of damim. Okay, Herb says, Rashi, Exodus 23:2, but I think Ani Omer, that if one wishes to explain the verse so that everything should fit in properly, it says Jesus must be as follows. Then we ask you about that judgment, or not give him a reply concerning the dispute, any statement, thereby, yes, pronounce the decision, yes, let the collar hang around the neck of the majority. There's an example. Herb gives us a very good example of Rashi expressing some concerns about the traditional rabbinic understanding of the text. The thief is bloodthirsty. Yes, that's a way of understanding. Totally confused. Jennifer writes, do you mean that someone else beat the thief to death so the homeowner had no blood guilt? No, it means whoever beat the person to death has no blood guilt. That's the standard halachic understanding, that you see somebody doing something nefarious like this, then you, the innocent bystander, are allowed to get involved and you will not be put on trial for doing that. Or even the homeowner beat the thief to death, but some of the thief was already dead. No, the reason that whoever beat him to death is not responsible is because he is considered, from a poetic, lyrical point of view, to have been dead already. Or to say lo damimi, that the thief metaphorically had no blood because he was breaking the law. That is correct, because we say that he knows. The Talmud explains that. I always used to wonder whether the Talmud would have explained this way in days when almost all of us, or maybe all of us, have homeowners insurance. But if you don't have insurance on the contents of your home and you see somebody breaking into your home, the Talmud says that every thief knows, every human being knows, ein adam ma'amid atzmo al mamono, that nobody is going to just stand aside and allow somebody to steal from them. I always used to tell my students at York University that if somebody was breaking into my house in the middle of the night, I would probably try to find a good place to hide so that they don't kill me. Yes, that's true. Yes, Epi says, that's right. I explained this before, the days when there were cell phones and didn't always have a telephone. But if you didn't have the telephone, I'd be more worried about getting hurt myself than about defending. But the assumption of the Talmud, and perhaps the only reason that I felt that way, it could be because I'm a wimp, or it could be because I had an insurance on my property, and so I would feel that the thing to do is just to be sure that the person doesn't kill you. But the Talmud's assumption is ein adam ma'amid atzmo al mamono, that you never stand there watching your own stuff being stolen, and the thief knows that. The thief knows that the homeowner is not just going to sit idly by and watch his goods get stolen. And since he knows that, that is ipso facto proof that he is willing to kill you. Yes, Susan.
I was going to say, I have a friend whose house was broken into during the day. And uh-huh. she happened to come home and the thief grabbed her arm, put a gun to her head, broke her shoulder. She would not be allowed to defend herself according to the Talmud because it says during the day. So what do you do during the day?
No, the Talmud did not say that. It was only Rabbah who said that. Why all these Talmudic texts are giving this, but that's not the halakha. The halakha follows Rambam, and Rambam would say that the person is allowed to defend herself in that situation without any doubt.
Also, he came in with a gun. So
right. Okay. That's ipso facto proof, prima facie proof that the person is willing to kill you.
I was just misunderstood the day stuff.
Yes. Totally confused. You mean that someone else beat the thief? Yes. Okay. We read that. Zev Price, please explain the second half of the pasuk that deals with when the sun is shining. The pronouns used here are confusing. So the second half of the pasuk, according to the understanding, is if there is certainty about the case that he is not trying to kill you, then damim lo, we consider the thief to still be alive in the sense that you're not allowed to kill the person, that there's certainty that he is not coming to kill you. You're not allowed to kill a thief because the thief is a thief. You're allowed to kill a thief only if you perceive that there is danger to you. It doesn't say habad lignov mimcha hashkem lahorko. It doesn't say if someone's coming to steal from you, you're allowed to kill them. But what it says is habad lahorgecha Hashkem lahorko. So that's the understanding of the second verse. Ilan, I asked, I don't understand how the thief could be considered dead if he was alive while tunneling. Oh, yes, he was. There's no question. Of course, he was alive. Like from a medical point of view, there's no question that he was alive. But it's saying that he had the halachic definition of being a dead person when he was breaking in. And that's why it would have been permissible to kill him, because you were killing somebody who was not alive. Gershon compares the Sanhedrin discussion of sons and fathers to Christian beliefs. I'm not going to go there, Gershon. We can correspond about that later if you like. Epi writes, the pshat of day versus night makes sense in the pre-electric era when night was the full opposite of day. It was very dark. Totally correct, Epi. That's something else that we do if we hear something... If we hear something in the middle of the night, we have lights that we're able to turn on. Can I tell the old joke here? Am I allowed to tell this old joke now that I live in Jerusalem? I don't know whether I'm allowed to or not, but I'll tell the joke anyways about the husband and wife who are in bed at night in Jerusalem, and they hear noises in their apartment, and the wife wakes up the husband and says, there's noise, there's somebody in our apartment. And she wakes him up, and he goes out of the room, and he comes back and he says, it's a thief. And she said, oh, good. I was worried that it was guests coming in. Yes, and all of you are welcome guests to come and visit here. People in Jerusalem sometimes like to joke about the invasion of guests. That halavai, there should be an invasion of guests. They should open up the border here, and people should be allowed to come here. The original safe room in Israel, it has additional uses or duties. Haven't some of these passages been abused in recent Israeli politics and history? Well, iPad, I am not going to go. I'm not going to go there. And anybody who wishes to talk about politics, we could talk about politics another time. Rabbi Kelman, do you have another class in 6 minutes, or do you
not? Not in 6 minutes. In 51 minutes.
In 51 minutes.
Sefer Yirmiyahu, the beginning of a 12-part series with Simi Peter. So. Everybody can have an extended lunch and then come back for 1 o'clock. By the way, it's interesting, you know, the word damim in Hebrew means, of course, both, you know, death and money, because clearly Chazal saw when you steal a person's money, you're taking away part of their life. I mean, you didn't get into that whole connection between damim used in this, you know, dual sense, but just whatever, for another time, if you'd like. But thank you very much. And we'll see you, please God, next week. Everybody should be well. Yirmiyahu at 1 o'clock. Moshe Sokolov on the Haftorah at 8 o'clock this evening. And tomorrow morning, Shuli Mishkin begins her series at 11 a.m. on the touring of Israel, 6-part series. And then tomorrow night, Rabbi Noah Chezis of Sharon, Massachusetts, used to be rabbi, the associate rabbi at Sher Shemaim here in Toronto, young, up-and-coming rabbi, or up-and-came rabbi, I don't know, here, is tomorrow night at 8:30 p.m., and then my Pirkei Avot Shir, 9:30 a.m. Friday morning. So we look forward to learning with you. Please invite a friend, and okay, everybody be well, and those who can make it in 49 minutes. Now we will see you soon, and thank you very much, everybody. Have a wonderful day.
Have a good week, everyone.
Bye-bye. Okay, yeah, be well. You hear good news.